Eric.
Hey, Charles.
How are you doing?
Good.
So we're in your building today.
We're in building 18, the most beautiful building on campus.
Excellent. Great shirt, man.
Thank you.
So who are we interrogating today? What's going on?
We're here with the Entity Framework team. It's Jeff.
Hey.
Hey. And, And so, yeah, we're going to hear everything about, you know, Jeff's history and, you know, about the Hexon and the EF and what he has in store for us.
Excellent. Cool.
So, so Jeff, how did you get into computer science?
How did I get into computer science? Well, it's that introverted high school path of, you know, I liked computers and not a whole lot of other people did. And we had a lot of Macintoshes in my high school, and I ended up signing up for some of the Macintosh developer, you know, classes. And
so you started in Pascal then?
It had just turned to C when I was...
This shows my age, right?
But I remember getting these gigantic binders with all the, like, the Mac OS system calls in them, and ended up writing a couple little games that I put up as shareware in America Online. And it was just fun writing software and, you know, thinking about the problems and, you know, I was just kind of doing it kind of ad hoc, figuring stuff out, and I'm sure my code was terrible and, you know, finally...
Hope it has improved in the meantime.
As soon as I got to college and they actually had computer science classes and that sort of thing, kind of learned more, you know, formally, you know, oh, so that's what you call that I've been doing. So that was kind of fun to do and just kept enjoying it. And for some reason, I always really liked data and database stuff and organizing information. So I kind of focused on taking a lot of database classes and, you know, advanced algorithms that had to do with managing data and moving information around and that sort of thing. So, ended up. And then when I ended up at Microsoft, that was kind of what I continued to focus on.
So what was your favorite course in college? Was it a database course or an algorithms course?
Probably just the introduction to, like, you know, algorithms and data structures. When you start learning about, like, you know, hash tables and different kind of trees and you know, that sort of thing, and just kind of, to me, it was almost like a visual thing of, like, you have this problem and how do you want to, you know, effectively store things and, like, you know, what kind of, well, that gives you fast access, but, you know, you can't insert things easily, and just that kind of stuff. I kind of saw that stuff and it was really, you know, that was my thing. It was easy to see. And you know, so that was probably my favorite.
And so how did you end up at Microsoft?
I ended up at Microsoft just through an internship. I did two internships at Microsoft when I was in school. The first one was on a team called WebData, which at the time they were writing all of the system.xml stuff. So I worked on XSLT and .NET before .NET was .NET. And I wrote an XSLT debugger plugin. That was a lot of fun. And then the next summer I came back and I worked in SQL Server worked on SQL XML and that kind of thing. So, and I loved the experience. I liked being out in the Northwest, and I love being around all the people who love the same stuff as me.
So where are you from originally?
So I kind of say the Midwest. I was born in Cincinnati, Ohio. Lived there for about 10 years, then we moved to New Jersey, then we moved for a couple years. And then we moved to Wisconsin. So,
where's your tent?
Where's my wife?
Oh, you come from Jersey.
No, I lived there for a short time.
Good one.
Yeah. So yeah, I kind of consider home kind of the Midwest, whether it's, you know, Ohio or Wisconsin or that sort of thing. So, and then I went to university out in New York, and now I'm out here.
Okay.
In Washington.
Good.
Excellent.
Yeah. So you mentioned XSLT,
yeah,
which is another interesting language,
yep,
where, you know, they used XML to represent programs.
Yeah.
Now, in the Entity Framework, they also started out using XML to represent a lot of things, and then you worked on getting rid of all that XML and turning it into curly braces.
Yeah, we didn't get rid of it, we just hid it. It's underneath the curtain.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, that was really something interesting because we released, you know, the first version of EF, and you know, some things, you know, just it didn't work out too well, and you know, people kind of saw it as missing a lot of functionality, and it was kind of being pulled in a lot of directions, and you know, I don't think people really saw, like, exactly where we were headed with it. We solve some of that in the next version in terms of like the feature gap, but people still kind of conceptually saw like, well, I want to access my data, and why'd you make that so hard? And really, it shouldn't be hard, especially for there's a lot of customers who are like, well, I want to write an application, I want to store data, but I don't want to have to learn a bunch of new stuff to do that. And you know what we did with kind of this most recent stuff we've been doing on Entity Framework, which we call like Code First and our DB Context API. You know, if you know how to code, you know how to store data now.
Yeah. But that's an interesting question. Like, why as developers, or maybe not as developers, but why do people like to take things out of code into config files or XML things, whereas, really what we live and breathe is code. That's and, all our tools are code-centric. You can put breakpoints and so on. So, and you see it here, right? You had this thing, and now you bring it back into code.
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's kind of this, search for, addressing the knobs that customers want you to put on stuff. And it's like, well, how do I, get all the flexibility I want? And, you can't do that, or you can't express that in code. And, so they look for alternatives. And, we end up with XML files and little XML languages within XML and config files and all that. And it's complicated pretty quickly. I think, you talk a lot about the shiny river rock, and, that when we did Code First, I can't tell you how many times people have said, well, make sure this is the shiny river rock. Are we hitting the 80% case and that kind of thing? If you want people to kind of go off down the happy path, then great, we're going to make that work. If we want people to, do something that, isn't really on the happy path, and how can we make that experience still really good, but not in everybody's face and that sort of thing. So we talked a lot about the focusing on the experience, how we thought people would use it, and if there are configuration options and stuff like that, we put them in. But we didn't focus on making it this gigantic extensible thing. But we did kind of design. We have a plan for how we're going to get the extensibility through code and that sort of thing. Going down the road, but just to get the first release out, that wasn't the focus of all the knobs. And
okay, so you focused on beauty and elegance and ease of use,
yeah,
instead of like hundreds and thousands of features. And
we primarily focused on like the web scenario. We worked really closely with the ASP.NET team and the MVC product, and they're like, well, this is how people want to write these MVC and these ASP.NET applications, and this is all they're trying to do. We just want to make that really simple, and right now this is what they have to do. And we looked at that together, and we're like, well, we could make that a lot easier. And they just want to do some queries and do that easily and use kind of some cool stuff with Link, and make it easy to put data into databases and create databases. And that's kind of what we did with Code First. We started with just a 4 pretty simple scenarios: get your data, insert it, update it, and delete it.
What else do you do with data? Right?
Exactly. and then it kind of evolved over that. Is like, well, this kind of new surface that we introduced, was so easy to use and kind of so focused that we realized that like a lot of the disparate functionality we had all over the Entity Framework, you really could condense and kind of re-expose as part of our DB Context API. And so we added that on as well.
So why do you think that it took, a few releases before you got that insight?
That's a good question. I think to some extent it was because, the Entity Framework as a product is something to a lot of different kinds of people. And really, if you think about Code First, Code First is one kind of view of what Entity Framework is all about. And it's going to help a certain set of customers, but it's not going to help everybody. And there is more to the Entity Framework in EDM than just Code First. And I think to some extent it's just, the age-old thing about, like, we have a certain number of people working on the product, and, we have a lot of goals. One of them is to make that developer experience great, and we wanted to make it great for the web developer and the service developer and that sort of thing. But we also wanted to, do some things with like modeling and, to make, people who are more focused on the database, more productive as well. And those are things we haven't gotten to yet. And so we tried to make a little bit of progress in a whole bunch of directions and ended up not really doing anything super well. But then we started to say, all right, well, we'll focus on the developer first. And we'll get that right.
Okay, so I find this a fascinating topic. Okay. So let's, as I'm putting here a question on my stack, because I want to ask a question about the XML files.
Yeah.
Right. Once you go, the XML files, you build them like upfront, and now your tool set can kind of, inspect and look at these XML files at compile time, kind of, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas now, when you do code first, you're writing code that at runtime generates these files, which has pros and cons.
Yes.
So how do you deal with that?
I think that the pros and cons. I mean, that's something that we really have to clearly talk about when we talk about the Entity Framework as a complete product and code first being part of that, because. You know, we've talked about, some customers, they're like, oh, yeah, this code first thing is great, but data is God. And, the database matters, and I want to see the database, and I want to see my model. And if I can't see that, I'm not using your product.
Okay, so you're saying is that they want to have an artifact that represents their database.
Yeah, and they want to be able to see it and, not leave things up to convention. They're very explicit about how things work. They have business policies that say, these things need to be in place for specific reasons because of their business. And, so that is one of the, just a communication challenge about, code first is a feature of the Entity Framework. It is not the Entity Framework. It is a feature of the Entity Framework. And, there's people who are going to love it because it, makes some concepts very easy. And there are people who aren't going to, be able to use it for one reason or another. But, some of the other challenges we had, certainly were, performance, always a big one. When you're doing all this computation about, all right, I need to, do reflection over a bunch of code that's never fast. And, not only am I doing reflection, I'm running a bunch of conventions over things. I'm running a bunch of rules to kind of get things from code, from one line, translating from one language to another, basically. And, you do all that, you want to cache that, and how do you cache it effectively? At what level do you cache things? And then, the other kind of problem is, all right, so now you have this new workflow with code. How does that work with the old workflow? Mm-hmm. Like, can you still see the model? And if you see the model, can you go back and edit your code? And like, how does that work? And that's something we're still kind of dealing with.
Because right now there's certain aspects of the model that are generated by running code, right?
Yes. Yeah. So. It actually makes tooling quite challenging because you have your Visual Studio, and typically there you reflect over things like config files or other XML artifacts, and that's how you kind of build visual representations of things. And this is to visualize a code first model, you not only have to like reflect over types, but you actually have to run code because they could have business logic in there that changes how the model looks.
Yeah. And so do people use that power where they kind of write, code that, depending on whatever inputs changes the models or the mappings?
The whole dynamic model scenario comes up every so often. And while we haven't really heard a big push about people using it in code first, I could see that code first helping in that scenario. But Entity Framework, as of today, isn't really yet geared for working real well with, dynamic, a dynamic model where, say, here's the base model and I want to add things over time, or, here's a model, here's another model with some slight changes. Can you reuse anything you did before? We can't do anything like that yet, but just in terms of making it easy for people to recreate a model, code first does a pretty good job of that.
So another question I always ask, if you look at, if you're an old guy like me, when object orientation started, people were saying, what is an object? That is something that represents a real-world entity. So object orientation started as a modeling language.
Yep.
So now, why do we need two modeling languages? Why can't we use, code as the model?
I think the real answer there is there's a lot in computing that has nothing to do with objects and nothing to do with code. I mean, you take like a SQL Server database schema is not really code. It's a schema.
But isn't that a type?
Oh, it's definitely a class. Like, if you want to see it in code, but you know, if you want to, you know, program against it and that sort of thing, you don't necessarily always use objects. You use SQL and that sort of thing. And you know, if you want to access the way a database is written right now, you don't always make object calls. You have to use SQL. And so, just the way that, you know, the ecosystem is out there right now, not everything is an object. And those systems, you know, how do you talk to those systems effectively? So, you know, we can go from objects to, you know, to SQL and help with that. And, you know, one of the things that we're thinking about doing with the Entity Framework is how can we put, you know, these data models, these, you know, other abstraction layers on top of SQL Server schemas and that sort of thing. So you can say, you know, for example, report not just over your schema, but you can report over a data model, you know, some interpretation of what that schema actually means. And so that's not something you necessarily need objects for. It's just you're going from one schema to another.
But do you see that in practice, you know, where do people start? Do they start with code, or do they start with a legacy database that they then need to translate into code?
I think they do both. You know, it was actually interesting when we released code first. We assumed that, you know, everyone was going to start with code and they're going to be using it, you know, to help build new databases and that sort of thing. We put, you know, I think it was by the time we had released our fourth CTP, the feedback we started to get, you know, was that about half of our customers were using it with existing databases, and they're like, yeah, we just love how this is easy to, you know, express how I'm mapping my objects to my existing databases, and if you just add a couple more features, this is going to be awesome. So we kind of took that as like, wow, we, you know, made a river rock that, you know, was not just useful for one set of people, but, you know, another set of people were like, yeah, this is really going to work. And so, yeah, we see about half the people willing to want to start with objects and use that to drive how the database looks and that sort of thing. And another set who are, here's my legacy database, and, you know, or maybe not even a legacy database. Here's my, you know, in production business, just wrote it database. And, you know, hey, I want to start using the Entity Framework to do data access on it. And it just makes it really easy. So.
And like a typical, do you have like numbers, like how many, you know, tables or types a typical EF application uses? And then what is the spread, you know, the variance there?
Yeah, I wish I could give you a very specific, and that comes up a lot. We ask, just, you know, every time we go to a conference, we try and poll people for that kind of thing. It really varies. I think the majority of people are using models that probably have fewer than 200 entities or 200 tables in them. There's probably a handful of apps. Well, there's probably a good number that are even fewer than 50. You can get a pretty good app going with, you know, fewer than 10 tables. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of the, you know, like conference websites and that sort of thing, I mean, you know, they have 10 tables and you can run a really great app with 10 tables. Or Netflix, for example, you know, probably has a schema of fewer than 50 tables. You know, we definitely see 200. There's a couple who, you know, go over 1,000 or even hit up to 2,000. We probably don't see very many because I think that they start hitting performance issues around that we know of around the Entity Framework when you get to models that big. So, and that's, you know, kind of on our roadmap is we know there's a bunch of large, you know, we call them enterprise scenarios. It's probably not a great name for them, but, you know, people who are concerned with larger models. You know, that there's a lot of performance stuff we want to do there about, you know, how we load the model, you know, how we use the model, how we visualize that model. There's a lot of work there.
And so when you have large models like that, are these models large because people want to model entities, or is it because they normalize their data in an extreme way and where, like, the tables don't necessarily represent, you know, real-life entities?
I think some of it is just, you know, extreme normalization. Like, we talked with one pretty large company. They had about 1,000 tables in their database, and what it was there was one base table which had, you know, some common information, and they had, like, 999 tables that had one FK to that base table, and, you know, that translated to an inheritance hierarchy of one with one base class and 999 derived classes, and that was just how they did things. You know, and you know that's kind of a, the enormous.
It's like having system.object and then like I don't know how many derived types the BCL has, like 40,000 or
But you know, other ones we see are people have their application and they're not necessarily thinking about, well, there's segments to my application. They're just like, let me suck the whole thing into one data model and I should be able to work with that, even though really all I'm using the Entity Framework for in this set of pages in my website or, you know, this particular part of my application is really only using a part of that model. And they really could separate it out and get some performance gains there. But that's not always that easy to do because usually there's not discrete sets in a lot of people's models we're seeing. And there are, you know, some common entities that kind of are shared across all those different segments. You know, like your customer entity might be, you know, part of, you know, sales and, you know, part of like how your employees are tracked and that sort of thing. And, you know, with their order processing and all that. And so a customer entity might need to be part of all of those models. And, you know, how do you think about modeling that? And there's a lot of design patterns that help with that, but those aren't the most accessible things. And I think that could be something that the Entity Framework helps with is you've got this big model and how do you think about writing a program with it easily and, you know, how do the tools or things like Code First make it more obvious that you're working with just this part of your app and, you know, there's all this other stuff around but it doesn't matter right now. You know, and can you visualize that and, you know, maybe because of that visualization, you know, help your business in some other way as well. So that's definitely kind of an area that we think is lacking in our product, and we think that customers would get a lot of value out of.
And so you mentioned inheritance. So do you have any idea, like, which encoding of inheritance people most typically use? And maybe you can explain to the viewers, you know, how people typically encode inheritance.
So, this is kind of
a little bit of education as well.
Yeah, of course. We just went through, in our last release of Code First, we went through kind of rewriting a lot of the code and refactoring the code to make it work better with the different kinds of inheritance mappings that you have between classes and the database. So what we're talking about here is you've got an inheritance hierarchy in C#, and there's really, or VB, there's one way to kind of express that in code. But on the database, there's lots of different schemas that you could use. So Entity Framework has three kind of mechanisms that that will work. The first is called table per hierarchy. So you can have that entire type hierarchy in one table, and you have what's called a discriminator column that says this row is, for example, a customer, and this second row is, you know, a derived customer, and that sort of thing. So you use that discriminator
column. And so then the columns are the unions of all the fields of all the types in the hierarchy.
Right. And so, you know, that's really good if you're querying like all the data. You know, give me all the types in the hierarchy. You know, you're querying one table, and you're sorting things out through the discriminator column. And so, it's pretty effective to do things that way. It's kind of a denormalized view of the database. So, you know, you see people who have a more normalized view of the database, where you don't want to repeat or have like, you know, the empty columns because you've got the union. And basically, that's called what we call table per type. Where you have, for each type, there's a table, and that table contains just the information that type introduces. So if you have a base type with properties A, B, and C in it, A, B, and C will be in there. And if you have a derived type with a property D and E, there'll be another table in the database that has D and E in it with a foreign key up to the other table to contain the rest of the data. So that's probably the most normalized you can get your data. And, you know, that's really good if you're querying, you know, one particular type really frequently, but is less effective if you're querying everything because you have to do a join over a lot of tables. It also can be fairly, if you have a very deep hierarchy, it can be fairly ineffective too because you're basically to query with that most derived, like leaf
you
node,
have to make
joins
all the
way up. So to solve that problem, there's a third mechanism in there, which we call table per concrete type, which basically says for every type, there's a bunch of properties on that type, there's properties on, you know, the base types all the way up, and all of those properties are in a table in the database. So in that previous example, what the derived type would have is a table in the database that had, you know, A, B, C, D, and E, you know, so basically all the base properties repeat in tables. So if you're querying a particular derived type, you query one table again. Gets a little bit harder to manage in the database because you can't have foreign keys in that situation.
Now your representation for each type is different, so how do you do like upcasting and...
That sort of thing. And you know, what we also found was interesting with Code First was, so the Entity Framework as a product actually supports some fairly rich mapping scenarios where, you know, you can have, start with like, you know, the table per hierarchy, you know, at the base, but then a certain, you know, set of derived types switch and start using table per type, and then switch again and start using table per concrete type, and then some of those, you know, types might be split into different tables, and you can do all of that. However, the tooling and, you know, the what we had with the Entity Framework in .NET 4.0, we made it very hard to do that. With Code First, we're seeing that actually people are able to kind of express those mappings much more easily because of the way the code expresses, you know, this type goes to this table or this part of this type goes to this table. And so we'll probably see a pretty big uptake in people being able to express a lot more complicated mappings more easily with the Entity Framework.
And so do these happen in the wild where people have different representations of inheritance in different part of the hierarchy?
Honestly, every now and then they do. I think people sometimes bump into it without really knowing that they are. And, you know, we see it the most with, you know, second and third versions where, you know, well, we wrote V1 and it had used basically TPH and everything was stored in one table. Then we wanted to add some more types, but we didn't really want to, you know, muddy that one table with other stuff. So we switched and we put all that other data over here, and now we don't know what to do with that. And, well, sure enough, what you've got there is TPH at the base, and then you've got a couple derived types that poke out, and they're TPT, and that's not all that hard to map anymore. But, and if you think about it, you know, what you've got with Code First is you're saying these types and these properties, this is the table you go to get the data from, and that's kind of the only concept you need to know to do those complicated mappings. So there's no XML language to figure out. So hopefully people will take advantage of that. But, you know, I think those are kind of the more rare case.
So another place where the relational model and objects differ is with respect to... the relationships, right? One-to-many collections. So there, I would like to ask you two questions about that.
Sure.
One is, if you look at in the object world, the collections themselves have identity, right? If I have, like, you know, customer with orders, now I can have also maybe, you know, a bill that has the same orders. So the orders collection itself is shared, whereas in the database, they often, you just have customers and orders with direct foreign keys. And so the second thing, and maybe, I think you probably will ask them in one go, the other thing that the database has is like many-to-many relationships where there's no real natural mapping in the object world. So how do you deal with those things?
So I can talk about many-to-many first. So many-to-many, you kind of, there are a couple patterns that you see in the database when people are trying to do a many-to-many. They use that join table in the middle. And so that's something that the Entity Framework has had from the first version, was basically, hey, if we see this little table in there and it's basically a join table with just keys to the two other tables, we're not going to make that an entity. We're going to kind of hide that fact, and we'll expose things as a many-to-many relationship. So that is kind of something that, you know, the Entity Framework knows about and can do, and is a fairly popular feature. You know, most people have some kind of join table in their database.
Yes, but the question is, can you from the join table see if they want to have a many-to-many relationship, or that they use that to model the collections themselves?
The collection, So that's something you can't do. Basically, there's a pattern, and we look at the pattern, and we say, hey, this is a join table, so we're going to interpret it as a many-to-many relationship.
How do you map that to an object model?
It's basically, you have, let's take your case where, you know, you have multiple customers, and customers can share orders. So an order can belong to, you know, many customers, and a customer can have many orders. So in that case, I would, you know, expect to see that in the databases. You have a customer table, an order table, and a table in between that has, you know, a foreign key to the customer and a foreign key to the orders. In the object world, what you would have is you'd have a customer object with a collection of orders on them, whether it's like an I collection of order or a list of collection or whatnot. And same thing on the order side. So it's just an I collection or a list of customer. And then what the entity framework does for you is it just manages the contents of those collections for you. So there's no real sharing of the actual collection instance. So to the entity framework, the collection instance has no identity into it of itself. It's just the holder of the contents. And the kind of the identity of the collection is the contents itself, not the actual instance of the collection. So, you know, Bill and Steve would have different instances of the collection, but the contents would be the same. Yep. So that's kind of how many-to-many works. And now I've already forgotten your first question.
Well, that was, you know, it was all intertwined, right? Because, you know, it all
there was
has
a foreign key.
There's the join table, right? And the join table is used for multiple purposes.
Yeah.
And where certain purposes work in the object world, others don't really match quite well.
Yeah, but it's kind of interesting because you can, you know, the whole thing about, like, well, the collections don't really have an identity into it of themselves, and, you know, would you ever want them to, and that kind of thing. And I think there are some scenarios that people kind of ask us about, you know, what if I have this relationship between two things and that relationship has like a payload of information along with it?
Yeah.
Or
that would be, by the way, my next question. So it's great. You know, it's like now I can just get coffee and you will cool. ask yourself questions.
That's the future of the series.
Or, all right. But, you know, the you know, or even like, you know, well, there's a set of things, and those set of things together have some additional payload information. And, you know, that's not something the entity framework kind of deals with right now. If you wanted to do something like that, you would need to stick an entity in there to help manage that information. But, you know, that leads to a particular coding pattern. And I think you see that with a lot of the object relational mapping technologies, whether it's the entity framework or and Hibernate or that sort of thing. Is that they all kind of prescribe, there's a certain set of programming patterns that you can use with them. And, you know, if you want to go, you know, outside of that, you usually have to either, you know, be willing to have some kind of private workarounds in your code, or you have to adapt, or you have to not use the product. And, you know, we certainly, you know, have hit our fair share of walls with that. You know, things like entity framework requires a default constructor on your entity classes today. And, you know, a lot of people are like, well, that sucks. I mean, like, what, you know, how can I have immutable classes that I can guarantee that? And it's like, well, you could write an FXCOP rule for that and analyze your code to make sure that no one is, you know, calling the default constructor. And it's like, well why do I have to have it then? That's terrible. So, you know, we hear that frequently.
What's the answer to that question?
We're working on it. So,
but I mean, just for like, from the peanut gallery, I mean, why would you force somebody to have a default constructor?
Well, again, it's like, you know, it's if you want to, this is like an interesting question, right? When people want to model things or want to do things that are maybe not expressible in the underlying CLR, so maybe they want to have immutable objects, but you still have to create the object, so at one point it is mutable, so... Mm. Often people trying to force invariance on the system that you cannot really express. And then in this case, you know, the underlying framework, you know, since it infers things or relies on certain properties of your code, now, you know, you're adding another layer of requirements on the user that, you know, they kind of, you know, interact with their intentions. But I'm a very pragmatic guy in that case. You're in an imperative language or you're in a general purpose language, so you have to just live with those things.
Right. And I think that there's, you know, there's varying click stops along the way, and like which ones are going to be the biggest blockers for people, and you certainly want to, you know, help with those first. That we hear about the default constructor and people wanting to use factory methods or, you know, a constructor that just has a bunch of parameters on it. You know, that's probably one of the biggest ones we hear about.
Yeah, and so do you also get, like, requests where people want to use interfaces and dependency injection and things like that?
Interfaces are big, and being able to kind of express that the interface is, you know, somehow part of the model and that sort of thing, and that you're not really going to know what the concrete type is of this interface until you actually do the query and you get the results back, and there's almost like a little discriminator in the table itself that that tells you what the concrete type is for that. So it's kind of like that TPH case we were talking about before, but just knowing how to deal with the interfaces is it's not yet an entity framework feature, but I think Anhibernate has that, and it's people use it and they use that pattern. Entity framework's not the answer for them, and Anhibernate is. So just goes back to what's the framework going to force you to do, and are you willing to live with that?
Another thing where that comes from the relational world is if you think about cubes and OLAP kind of things, do you have any support for that to map those into objects?
Kind of the whole analytics and doing analytics over your model is something that I think we're just starting to think about how to do that. I mean, with the way that things are now, it would probably be like trying to build your cube by just executing SQL you could cook up yourself, and that's not very efficient at all. So we're not there yet, but I think that's definitely a direction we want to take is, how can we analyze the model and what the model's going to do to build these interesting, the cubes and that sort of thing to get the data out of. And that's where having that intermediate language that you can reason about and maybe an easier way because it's not CLR objects can be useful. It's in the plan. And that's, again, where it's like, there's a lot of directions we could, pull the product.
Yeah, because that's like, there's a lot of features inside SQL.
Absolutely.
Right? And so how do you prioritize which ones you expose?
Right. And, and so that's where it was like in that first version, we started working down a path, could we expose, some additional things in SQL Server, or should we do kind of this ORM layer, or should we have more of like just an ADO.NET provider? And we kind of did a little bit of both and, didn't kind of give a great experience at any of the levels. But that is kind of our constant, prioritization exercise is, we want to give a great developer experience. We want to, expose database features and particular SQL Server features because there's a lot of cool stuff out there. And then the other one is, can you be just the most performant, data access stack, possible. So kind of between those three things, we kind of have a dial and, each release we kind of look at, what are the biggest gaps, and we've got some pretty big ones with EF4, things like we don't yet support some of even the SQL 2008 data types, like the spatial types and hierarchy ID and that sort of thing, and don't support file stream yet, and those are big gaps there. But then you look at what about the developer productivity and features like code first, or a developer productivity thing about an enum. Well, enums are not a database feature. They're a representation of how you do it. And so, enums are probably our number one requested feature, even over code first. Enums are the most requested feature. And, so it's like, we get pulled and asked from a lot of different people. So in that,
When you prioritize things, is there like a feedback loop with the actual users, and how do you interact with users in general?
Yeah, so we've been really trying to be active with our blogs. We have a design blog where when we're thinking about adding a feature like enums, which we're working on right now, wish I could show you a demo, but we're working on enums right now, and we'll put an EF design blog post out there with these are our thoughts about how it's going to look and the model, how you'll be able to use it with code first, how it'll show up in the designer, how you'll be able to use it in your objects, and what do you think about that? And so we'll get feedback through the forum post there. At conferences, we talk about our products, PDC and TechEd, that sort of thing, TechReady. We get a lot of direct email from people just saying hey, I tried this and it didn't work. We go through our forums a lot, and what we see, the forums are interesting because usually people have a very specific problem when they go to the forums. I'm trying to do X, and it doesn't work. What am I trying to do there? And, you can go and you can answer the forum post, and you've done a good job. You've made that particular customer happy, but, if you actually spend a lot of time looking through the forums, you can find the patterns for what people are working on and what stuff, doesn't work for them, and those are the things that really turn into the useful features.
Yes, I 100% agree. It's like you have to kind of see, because usually a user has a particular problem, but now you can see, oh, I see, 100 users that all have a similar problem. So if we would add this feature, then that work would work for everybody.
Yeah, and so that's where it's like we use the forums, the blogs, the conference data, the emails, our Microsoft MVPs and insiders. You know, it's all those sources of data for us. Bug reports we get. And we kind of look at, you know, where are people having, you know, the biggest problems. You know, what are the adoption blockers, and you know, how can we give a solution to that that really makes sense and is something nice, like code first.
So and you said that you were working on enums right now.
Yep.
Can you explain what is the problem? How hard can enums be?
How hard? Well, we had a particular individual who asked us, you know, the same question. How hard could this be? Like, how can you not just do this? And like, it should take a day.
Yes.
To do that.
Yeah.
But then you look at like, well, what does it really mean to add enums to the Entity Framework product? So the Entity Framework has this EDM modeling language, so an XML format. So okay, great. It should take you 10 minutes to add enums into an XML format. And then we have you know, all right. Well, how do you actually do the SQL translation? So you know, when you've got your query expression down and like you're putting that into an actual query to get your results back, you have to take that XML representation and know how to do the query. We have to do the same thing with insert, update, deletes. So you have to change the query pipeline and the insert, update, delete pipeline. Then we have a link translator. So if you're expressing the query in link, how do you actually take the link query, which is CLR objects, and translate that down into your query tree or your update tree or that sort of, well, link, just query tree. We also have a textual query language in the Entity Framework called Entity SQL or eSQL. So that needs a parser. You know, how do the enums show up there?
Well, we've changed type checker.
Type checker and that sort of thing. We have, we do identity, we do kind of change tracking and identity resolution on your objects. So, you know, those we have to make sure those work with enums. We generate proxies for objects and those have to work with enums. We generate code off that model and we generate code in, you know, 4 or 5 different ways, depending on what you want. So all those need to make sure that they spit out enums when you've got enums in there. We've got code first now, and that's got to work with enums. We have to build tools. We have to have dialogues for enums, and we have to make sure that all those things are localized in all the languages we work with. And sooner or later that day turned into a week, which turned into a month, and it makes me really sad. So.
Well, but again, I think that does show the kind of reality of working on a commercial product.
Yep.
Is that, you know, often even what looks like a small thing initially has so many implications and its roots in so many different places.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and it's tough because you think about like, well, we know that enums are going to be used in these kind of scenarios, so could we possibly narrow where enums show up? And, you know, and we could, but then it's like, well, you know, is there any efficiency in us doing it once and doing it right, you know, through the whole product? And there's that question because, you know, eventually those scenarios that you didn't think about today are going to be scenarios that are important in the future. You know, like if we only supported in the object layer, but not in our underlying model or anything like that. Well, if we then use the model to do our analytics when we go to work on those features, well, now what if you want enums there and we would have to add it there? So. You know, we found that kind of doing it right throughout the product is important, but we're very conscious about, you know, are there places where we don't see enums showing up, and how is that, you know, if we didn't do it there, you know, what's the consequence of that? And you know, especially with exposing things out into .NET objects, you know, then you've got a lot of other teams at Microsoft who want to use enums, like, hey, I want to do, you know, scaffolding in my ASP.NET application. I want to use enums, and I want to scaffold a particular page around that. And so, like, how do you get the way we expose enums to work with them and, you know, in WPF and the drag and drop designers and get those to work? So there's a lot of people to coordinate with and, you know, make sure that what we're doing, that design is going to work for not just our customers, but for the other kind of customers at Microsoft. So, so unfortunately, that's why it doesn't take a day. But,
That's the way it is. So I want to switch gears a little bit now, and instead of talking about the product, talk about like how you built the product. So what kind of tools do you use when you write code?
So primarily what I use and folks on my team use, we use Visual Studio 2010. A lot of people use ReSharper, great little refactoring tool, a lot of nice things in there. We do some... modifications of T4 templates, and so we use Notepad for that a lot of times, or There's a nice editor called Tangible, T4 editor that you can get on the VS Extension Gallery that colorizes things and makes things nice. But those are the primary developer tools we use. We just use our own stuff, Visual Studio.
And so what do you use for source control?
So for source control, we use TFS. We kind of are, and that's largely true for most of the, what we call our developer division. The teams that produce Visual Studio and the .NET framework use TFS now. We used to use Source Depot. We switched to TFS. And, there's just a very large branch system where you've got a couple thousand people contributing to that branch system for all the different kind of teams and, different kind of feature areas that you've got on Visual Studio and the .NET framework. So we still use that. We use TFS to help track our bugs and our work items and, how we've spent a couple years, but we kind of switched to kind of the more agile sprint model, and we use kind of TFS to help track, our sprints worth of work items, and it's nice because people can kind of go in on their own machines and make updates there. We use a Microsoft in-house source code reviews to do code reviews tool called CodeFlow. Which is kind of cool, and it because with TFS you can make shelf sets and they're stored on the server, which was nice. But you still, if I wanted to send you a code review, I'd have to send you an email and I'd have to wait for a reply, and it's not tracked anywhere. And you get the email and you'd have to paste it into your environment and look at the code review and look at the diff and all that. And so what CodeFlow helps with is it has the diff built in, and it's got a nice way of storing and exchanging a dialogue during the code review, which I think was really helpful for people because, now not only could I send the code review to one person, I could send it to, my entire team. Whoever got to it could do it, but anybody could look at it and see what issues we're discussing in the code review. You can put comments in there and resolve issues, and it's a pretty nice tool. I actually think we should work it into one of our shipping products. But,
so most of the code reviews are done electronically, not where you go and sit in the developer's office and then discuss.
I think that's definitely true for the incremental changes we make. Everybody uses virtual machines. Usually everybody's got 2, 3, 4 running, and so send out a shelf set code review, switch to another VM, start working on something else while you kind of wait for that one. When we do kind of a larger kind of initiative, like when we did, a significant refactoring of CodeFirst, or we started working on our DB Context API, and we had one or two developers kind of working in isolation for a while, and we think that we've done enough to make this product code, we'll kind of sit in a room together and kind of review it, project it, and walk everybody through it and talk about issues. But, definitely for the incremental stuff, we still favor kind of the electronic code reviews and kind of unbiased view of stuff.
Yeah. So when you're actually developing code, do you use test-driven development or how do you do unit testing and things like that?
Yeah, so that's actually a really good question. I mean, we have started doing more test-driven development, and I think that's helped a lot. I think the other thing that has kind of, we transitioned a bit is, just the kinds of tests we wrote as part of our check-in tests in particular. So, typically we wrote primarily functional and integration level tests, so we would create our context and we would execute a link query and we would look at the result that came back. But so much happens in the process of that it was like you could get the query to do what you wanted, but it was also doing a ton of other stuff. And so we kind of did a big initiative to make sure that we were, had the capability to be able to do, much more unit level testing, to easily call the internal and private and protected methods inside there, and able to use tools like mock. And how do we did a big education, on our team to say like, all right, well, testability isn't about, having great test tools and test frameworks and that sort of thing. Testability is about how you design your software, and you got to make it testable when you design it. You have to have the right seams and all that sort of thing. And so we worked pretty hard on that to make sure the code was more testable. And with CodeFirst, particularly, we kind of started using a lot of these new processes and new design methodologies of, viewer statics, fewer stuff, you know, created, you know, initialized, you know, in the constructor and that sort of thing, you know, pass things in, more dependency injection, that sort of thing. And it allowed us to, like, write, you know, unit tests much more prolifically. And I think that helped a lot, both in terms of, you know, being able to test and the quality of the smaller pieces improved, but just our understanding of, like, hey, I've got this piece and it's going to be used in these different ways. And, you know, people actually got the code that they were writing a lot better.
And so do you feel that when you think more about the testability of your code, that you understand your code better and that you start writing, you know, higher quality code just because you're more into it?
Sometimes. I think when you focus on the unit level, sometimes you lose the experience that you're going after. So I think it's kind of a balance. Like, you know, if I'm using a particular algorithm that I'm testing and that sort of thing, and, you know, I can make sure that algorithm is really great, but is that algorithm really solving, you know, the bigger problem in the right way? And what's the experience of when that's being used kind of outside of that? So it is a balance, and we don't just do the unit level testing. You know, I think in terms of like understanding what that algorithm does and all the corner cases, then yes, we get much better clarity there. But that doesn't help us with how does that piece fit into the bigger experience. So on the flip side, we're always in the middle, and now we're doing more unit level testing, but we're also doing a lot more of these end to end, you know, kind of app building exercises. Where
and so who drives those? Is that developers, or does that come from the PMs, or?
It primarily comes from our test team, we kind of partition things so that, you know, devs are writing more functional tests and they're writing more of these unit level tests, and then the test team will propose, well, I'm going to build this kind of app, and this is what I'm going to have the app do. I'm going to make sure it's automated to run on that sort of thing. They'll write the app and they'll write a report that says, this was my experience, you know, using the app, writing, you know, using our product, writing this app, and, you know, this is stuff I liked, this is stuff that, you know, I absolutely didn't work at all and I hated, and this is stuff that was okay. And so we take that feedback and we loop it back into our design process, and we say, like, all right, well, you know, are any of these things, can we live with this, or, you know, is this a greater problem? And I think that's the other thing that's helped us, you know, polish kind of the experience better is, you know, having those kind of app level tests where, you know, we're using it with MVC, we're using it with WPF, you know, we're using it to actually do what people are actually doing with our product and making sure they, you know, that level works a lot better. And, you know, it's not just about functionally does it work, yes or no, but, you know, how does it feel to use it? And if it feels good and you get more green than red in your report, then you've done a good job.
You know, it's unfortunate in some sense in the engineering discipline that we labeled testers,
right?
So devs and testers. Because in some sense, testers are the purest form of customer advocate.
Yep.
Because they're the ones who explicitly you're reaching with your code. They're developers too, let's be honest. But, that, you know, it's unfortunate that we had to create the terminology. I just want to throw that out there.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic that we have this process where we also think about, like, the whole experience and how you use the product in building things.
Yeah.
Because,
yes,
as you say, it's easy, you know, to get all caught up and, you know, and then you lose, you know, the big picture.
Yeah. I mean, and to your point about, you know, dev and test roles and stuff like that, I mean, it is frustrating at times when, like, you know, you've got, you know, someone from the test discipline who finds an issue with the code, and they're like, you know, they've done their diligence, and they're like, well, yeah, the problem is right here. And they basically paste the line of code into a bug report. Mm-hmm. They send it to the dev, and the dev then looks at it and has to understand it, build a repro, and fix it. And it's like, just fix the bug. Yeah. You know, you found it. So I think that's something that, you know, within the discipline roles of dev, test, PM, and all that, mm-hmm, I think we're going to start experimenting with, you know, how do we make it a lot more fluid within our team about, you know, hey, we're all engineers. And,
exactly.
And, you know.
Except for the PMs. Just kidding, guys.
We've got the PMs.
I'm just playing.
Throw them
I'm
the
just,
bus.
Oh, you know what? Neither will I.
So I think that, you know, I definitely think there's some efficiencies there and that we can get by, you know, relaxing the boundary of, you know.
But I mean, if a tester tells you, say, hey, you know, because I've played both roles, right? I used to be a test when I first started in software. Then I was the dev, and the role was the first. But in some sense, you know, if a tester tells you, hey, I tried to build this using your code and it sucked. The experience was terrible. Boom. Don't let customers ever get that, right? There's the proxy for you right there.
Yeah, exactly.
And so that's really...
And the worst thing that we could possibly do from the dev side is when that happens and the testers say, well, I couldn't possibly use what you just wrote. The dev says, well, you're using it wrong. You know, I think that, you know, it's like, oh, well, you got to configure this a different way and that sort of thing. It's like, well, I, as a tester, as a customer, used it this way. I thought it should work. Why didn't it work? And, you know, it's like, well, sure. So every now and then there's going to be some fundamental thing like you weren't using your computer when you tried it. So,
oh my God.
Yeah, no, that's never happened.
We don't hire those kind of.
But you know, a lot of times it's, you know, there's just a fundamental, you know, misunderstanding of, you know, a concept or something like that that just doesn't surface the right way. And, you know, you gotta, that should be, you know, a warning sign that this isn't right. There's a design problem.
So to, And the conversation, I would like to see if you have like a cherry on top. So you said you were working on enums. So is there kind of, you know, anything like other things that, you know, you can that
talk about
for the users and that you can talk about, of course.
Yeah,
but you know,
so,
don't say anything that you cannot talk about. But,
No. So, you know, well, we just released our Entity Framework 4.1 release.
Exactly.
Which has, you know, the code first feature and our DB context API feature set in there. You know, a lot of customers are kind of still asking, well, where's like migration support or enum support or table value function support? And, you know, all those things are coming. I've got people working on all that stuff. So
what will be the next version number? Will that be 4.2 or 5.0?
Well, it's a... That is a good question. I am not a lawyer, so. you know, it could very well be 4.2. We might try and do like a 4.1 refresh where we get some of the things that, you know, we knew were missing from our 4.1 release that, you know, customers have said, you know, these are big blockers for us. We love what you're doing, but still got a couple blockers. So we could refresh that. But, you know, we are working on a pretty significant feature set that includes enums, Sprocs with multiple result sets, migrations, you know, spatial data type, you know, like geography, geometry, that sort of thing. Being able to use those with link. I actually saw a really cool demo from one of our devs the other day where they did a link query to pull back a bunch of spatial data and displayed it on a map and a website. And I was like, oh, cool. So
nice.
So that stuff's coming, and we're going to try and get CTPs of that stuff out sometime soon. You know, we're hoping, you know, sometime, hopefully this summer, people will be able to start looking at that stuff. They'll be able to show it to people more publicly. But, you know, until then, we've got our blogs. We're going to kind of be as transparent as we can with that.
And Charles will put all the links, of course.
Yes,
and,
yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Well, thank you so much. This is great.
Thanks.
And I'm looking forward to, you know, everybody download EF 4.1 and start playing with it.
Excellent.
Okay. Sounds good. All right.
Take care.
See ya.